I'm Rick Sanchez. I've been doing news now for some 30 years, as you may know, in two languages, by the way, and not just here in the United States, but all over the world. And I've interviewed like four or five U.S. presidents, worked at different television networks. And from all that, and the reason I say it is because I've learned that news needs to be honest and direct and impactful. And this is Direct Impact. You know, I've noticed recently that global summits, which are not supposed to be competitions, but they seem recently like that's the way things are framing up. Both with, for example, BRICS on the one hand, the summit, and the G20 on the other hand. Both were held earlier this year, one in South Africa, the other in India, respectively. And I think this may be a good time to assess what we've learned from these two, shall I say, competing summits. The BRICS summit seems to have put the G20 kind of to shame, because it actually went as far as to put many of the G20 countries on notice, telling them in no uncertain terms that their warlike economic tactics are not appreciated. So that's what came from BRICS, kind of targeting G20 countries. And how did the members of the G20 countries summit respond? Basically by telling the BRICS guys that if they're going to point fingers, then they're going to do the same and point fingers back. And that's exactly what leading members of the G20 did then by using their platform to go after Russia and to go after China. No surprise there, right, from the G20? All except for one thing. While the BRICS nations were united on most of the stuff that they talked about, the G20 nations were not. I'll give you an example. India and Brazil simply did not go along with the narrative and chose not to take part in the China bashing, or for that matter, the Russia bashing. They just chose not to do so, despite what the other countries at G20 were saying. It's important to note that that sentiment, their sentiment, reflects a growing power shift from the global south, where suddenly countries in both Africa and Latin America are pushing back from rubber stamping that used to be expected of them. In fact, those countries who now say that for years they have been victimized economically seem more interested in overhauling, for example, the World Bank than they were in attacking Russia and attacking China. Now, and when it comes to global news coverage, you know, the G20 summit didn't get a lot of coverage. BRICS made headlines seemingly all over the world, but the G20 didn't. What does that say? By the way, what little coverage the G20 did get, it was not all that positive. I'll give you an example. Argentina's La Nación, a newspaper, wrote about President Joe Biden not knowing who their country's top political candidate was. Because when asked about presidential frontrunner Javier Milei, Mr. Biden reportedly said, "Who is that character?" That's what he said. Who is that character? In Mexico's daily Excelsior, the newspaper, the Excelsior, the headline read, "The Ukraine War Absent at the G20. Absent at the G20, as it reported that G20 nations were actually more interested in tackling climate change than in criticizing Russia. Argentina's other daily, El Clarín, wrote about Chinese President Xi Jinping not showing up at the G20 and his conflict with the U.S., the ongoing conflict, obviously. Then there's Lula da Silva, who seemed to scoff at the international court for issuing an arrest warrant for Russian President Vladimir Putin by inviting Mr. Putin to next year's summit in Brazil with a promise that he will personally protect him from arrest. So look, whether it's Latin America, Asia, India, or the Middle East, there is no denying that countries see the G20 very different from how they used to see the G20. Not only are they no longer falling in line with Western narratives, they are now also offering their own replacement narratives. And it's happening more and more. Slovakia, for example, which borders Ukraine, they just completed new parliamentary elections, and the winner is this man right here, Robert Fico, or Fico, I think they call him Fico, who will now lead Slovakia. I mean, which is a NATO country. Slovakia is a NATO country. And this gentleman came out, Fico, right after his election, and he said essentially, no more money for Ukraine.
Budem sa uchádzať ako predseda víťaznej strany o pozíciu predsedu vlády. Nič iné urobiť nemôžem v tomto okamihu, bolo by to sklamanie ľudí, keby som povedal niečo iné. Túto povinnosť mám a dáme do toho všetko.
It's really a stunning statement, this that he's doing, this thing that he's doing, where he's just basically saying, look, Ukraine may need money, but so do my people. And because it's a stunning statement that puts NATO in a bit of a precarious place to hear one of its nations come out and declare something like that after an election. But there's another equally stunning statement that I want to share with you, maybe even more pointed. This one comes from the United States, none other than Senator Rand Paul, who may have delivered one of the most convincing speeches yet, say many, on the question of sending more arms and more money to Ukraine. By the way, normally at this time in this show that we bring you weekly, we bring in a guest and we analyze this. But I want to share a good part of this. I want you to hear instead part of this speech that was delivered in Congress by Senator Rand Paul, but of course generally ignored by most of the corporate media. Here it is.
If this bill passes, the U.S. will have authorized roughly $60 billion in total spending for Ukraine. For those who say this is not enough, for those of you in this chamber who say that our military spending is never enough, let's put $60 billion into perspective. According to Elias Youssef, a security assistant at the Stimson Center, Kyiv would become the largest yearly recipient of U.S. military aid of the past two decades. Except for the top five countries, $60 billion is more than every other country in the world spends on their entire military expenditures. If this gift to Ukraine passes, our total aid to Ukraine will almost equal the entire military budget of Russia. And it's not as if we have that money lying around. We will have to borrow that money from China to send it to Ukraine.
I got to tell you, I, like most proper journalists, I'm not in the business of promulgating any politician's ideology. And in fact, I probably should let you know that I have on many occasions disagreed with Senator Rand Paul's positions on things. But in this case, given just his, if nothing else, clarity regarding where we are getting the money that we then send to Ukraine, for example, as well as his explanation of why the Ukrainian government may not necessarily be what we are all told they are, I thought it would be important that you and others, even those who may disagree with him, at least get a chance to hear his point of view. So let's talk about this, and let's do so with the perfect guest in this case, because Daniel McAdams is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute. And since we're going to be talking about Rand Paul's statement, it's really important to have this discussion with Dan. Dan, thanks for joining us. I want to start, though, with something else. I want to start with the whole idea of something that I've seen happening recently. I get a sense that the G20s of the world and the G7s and the Americas Summit and all of these formerly super cool summits and meetings that were held by leaders from all over the world are not getting the same attention or respect that we're now seeing in the competing summits like the Belt and Road, BRICS, the Lula Summit for Latin America, etc. What's going on here? Why is that? Why am I seeing that?
It's just fascinating to see, Rick. And thanks for having me on, by the way. There's a tectonic shift going on in the world right now. And it's very ironic because the U.S. has done everything it has says that it's done everything it can to prevent it. But actually, U.S. foreign policy is encouraging it and accelerating this move away from the global north, for lack of a better term, toward the global south. And that's why you see things like the BRICS summit. Everyone wants to join. Like you say, yeah, it's where the cool kids hang out. Everyone wants to join BRICS. Whereas you have the G20, It was tired. It was dead. They couldn't agree on any kind of statement. The U.S. wanted to use it again. They wanted to hijack the summit as a tool of its foreign policy as anti-Russia and pro-Ukraine foreign policy. That didn't work. So basically nothing came out of it. It was just a very expensive junket. And I mean, the contrast with BRICS and the others you mentioned is stark.
Are the chickens coming home to roost when it comes to our foreign policy? I mean, is that why we're seeing countries, as you say, wanting to hang out with the cool kids at BRICS? Because they're coming together and saying, you know, these guys have been screwing us for so long economically and in other ways. We still want to be their friends, but we're just going to go over here and make our own club.
Well, what I think happened is that sanctions is the primary tool of U.S. foreign policy. That's literally all we have. Do what we say or we'll sanction you. If that doesn't work, we'll bomb you. And the rest of the world is understandably sick of it. And so sanctions reached a point of no return. You sanction the hell out of Iran and they make deals with Russia. They make deals around the region. They make peace with Saudi Arabia with the help of China. I mean, I've been doing foreign policy for a long time, Rick. I never saw that coming. I never thought I would see Iran, Saudi Arabia, China sitting down and the two of them mending their fences. So,
and it's actually Iran, Saudi Arabia, China, Russia, India, to a certain extent. And prior to this situation that's going on now with Hamas and Israel, even Israel was inching toward grouping with those folks. Weird, huh?
Yeah, it was weird. And don't forget Iran, which is a regional powerhouse now. And now we're seeing, speaking of Israel, I mean, we're seeing to a degree that it's a paper tiger. It's not the powerhouse. Absent nuclear weapons, it would be a pushover. You know, we're seeing the destruction, basically, of the myth of Israel's invincibility. So that leaves Iran a major player in the region. Syria now a major player now that Assad has defeated, for the most part, the U.S.-backed al-Qaeda and ISIS. U.S. and Israel-backed al-Qaeda and ISIS there. So you're seeing a massive, massive shift. And in a sense, it's left Israel out in the cold. And I think that might explain some of the things that have been happening over the past couple of weeks, because Israel's left without a protector.
I got something for you, because as you're speaking, I just looked down at my phone and I just got an alert. You know, us boring, nerdy journalists, we literally get alerts from, this is from the Miami Herald, telling me that there's a breaking news story once again that Ron DeSantis is, let me make sure I get this right. Ron DeSantis is moving forward on pushing the state legislature to sanction Iran. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, is going to sanction Iran.
I guess he thinks he's won.
I mean, it seems foolhardy. It seems like just cockamamie politics. First of all, he's not a country. I mean, this is like political showmanship, I guess. He wants Jewish Americans in Florida to vote for him?
Well, he did. I mean, didn't he have the, he held a meeting of the state legislatures in Jerusalem, I think, last year it was. I think he's done that twice. So he has a very strong tie there, I guess.
And look, this is not, I don't want to pick on him. I mean, but it's like he's a guy running for, it's just like, what are you doing? I mean, what about the police? What about fixing my roads? What about make sure insurance policies are going to be able to be available to the citizens of this state where I am right now because they're all leaving because of the hurricanes? And yet, instead, he's worried about sanctioning Iran?
Yeah, he's got the boomer. He doesn't have his ear to the pulse of the people. And it's not only on Israel policy. In fact, Rick, I was just looking at a new poll that came out, CBS YouGov poll, astonishing. They asked, do you support sending support and weapons to Israel? And among Republicans, it was only 57%. Among Democrats, it was less than 50%. And among independents, it was far less than 50%. So the world is changing. It's like the Cuba policy. The younger generation just doesn't have these old ideas about we got to support Israel no matter what. We've got to sanction the hell out of Cuba, you know, till they all starve and get rid of their commies. The world is changing radically, and people like Ron DeSantis, they just don't see it coming.
Well, and Ron DeSantis is emblematic of what we see in Congress, right? The Ron DeSantis attitude that we just talked about, because that happened to come through my iPhone, is similar to what we hear from the majority of the people in the Senate, who, by the way, are almost dead. They're 80 or 90 years old, and they still live in the 1940s and 50s where they think there's a Cold War going on. And, you know, the funny thing is, as you say, most people do not feel that way, but they do. That's why recently when Rand Paul stood up and made that statement that was not covered by the general media, but we are covering it here, I just thought, if nothing else, it was, agree with him or not, it was refreshing to hear somebody say, why are we borrowing money from China to give it to Ukraine? We can't afford $100 billion with everything that we've got going on in this country. Oh, and by the way, the country we're giving it to that we're saying is a great democracy is really not that much of a great democracy. What did you think of that?
They just outlawed the biggest church in Ukraine. I mean, they literally outlawed the church. So that, what does that tell you? They no elections. They outlawed the competing political parties. They outlawed the opposition media. And now they outlawed the church. So that's a great, it's a great democracy. I mean, I do think that, that, you know, train to, has left the station to a degree. I mean, that's why they're trying to tie together the money for Israel and the money for Ukraine in this big $100 billion bill, because they see the writing on the wall with regard to Ukraine. They know it's a lost cause. The American people are absolutely opposed to sending money to Ukraine. I think among Republican voters, the last poll I saw was like 74% against sending more money to Ukraine. So it's deeply, deeply unpopular, an unpopular view. And the politicians, I think, are just starting to catch up with the people.
Dan, do me a favor. Stay right there, because I want to come back and continue to talk about the situation as it relates to both Ukraine and the situation that could be escalatory in between Hamas and Israel. As far as the whole geopolitics shift that you mentioned that's taking place in the world, we're talking to Daniel McAdams. We'll be right back. By the way, I always want to continue the conversation with you. And all you got to do so we can continue that conversation is go over to Twitter or X, where my handle is RickSanchezTV. Look for me, RickSanchezTV. I would really like to hear what you have to say, whether you agree or disagree with me. All right, when we come back, let's talk about that speech by Senator Rand Paul with our guests and questions that are normally, once again, not asked. Don't go away. And welcome back. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, one of the most important transformations that is taking place in the world today, especially in the conflict between East and West, is the union that is being established by certain groupings of country. Where there used to be one, two, or three organizations like OAS or G20 or G7 who seem to represent, quote, unquote, the world, now there are other organizations out there which seem to have a competing point of view. And those two points of view are reaching a point of almost intersection that will likely create one of two things as we look at it from here. Either more conflict or more understanding. Which will it be? We're joined once again by Daniel McAdam. He is the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute. Many of you who watch us from all over the world, millions of you, I know, because I've seen the numbers, I've seen conversations in the past that I've had with Dan. He's a proponent of trying to come up with a better way of handling our foreign policy. And to that note, I want to ask you something, Dan, about Russia's making incredible inroads in Africa, according to all reports that we see globally. China's had inroads all over the world, but in particular in Latin America, interestingly enough. So as an American, as a proud American, it bothers me that we're losing certain parts of the world. And I guess I would ask you, as someone who's been kind of a follower of the Ron Paul principle that we're making too many mistakes in foreign policy, what do we need to do to get those regions back? Or can we?
Well, not for a while. ironically, what Russia and China are doing is essentially non-interventionism. I mean, I think that someone in Latin America said, when China comes, they bring their checkbook. When America comes, they bring a lecture, you know, and that's how it is. You know, Russia is not trying to overthrow governments overseas. In some ways, their non-interventionism, even in places close by like Armenia, you could consider it even threatening to their security, but they're not going overseas. They're not telling Africa, and Africa is undergoing right now a very strong anti-colonial spirit. We see it everywhere throughout the region. And part of that is a reaction to U.S. interventionist foreign policy, starting with Libya, for example, which unleashed the forces of hell throughout Africa. And that was the U.S. doing. And now Russia is trying to pick up the pieces. They're trying to pick up the pieces. They're active in Russia. They're active in the rest of the continent. They basically took a position of non-intervention in Niger while the U.S. was telling them, you've got to restore your government. You've got to do this and that. They just stood back and waited for things to happen. So ironically, they're coming with business deals, not claiming that they're angels, but they're not coming with lectures and bombs and sanctions. And I think that's the key, non-interventionism, friendship with all who seek it. I mean, this is our founders' principles, friendship and free trade with all who seek the same with us. That's how we win it back.
Maybe I should ask the question this way. That makes sense, what you just said. And we should be looking for friends. And I think we have had experiences in the past with presidents like Kennedy, perhaps, who tried that. But what are the forces that are keeping us from going out there with an open hand rather than a closed fist? Who's doing this and why?
Well, a lot of it's the military-industrial complex. They drive U.S. foreign policy. They fund the campaigns of people on Capitol Hill. Or they fund presidents. They fund congressmen. They fund the think tanks who come up with brilliant idea that a war would be just terrific. They fund the media, and they are our tax dollars are being stolen from us to give them to keep replenishing the war machine. So I think that is the critical, this deep, deep corruption in American society. That our entire economy is driven by war. And it'll come home to roost because the working men and women of this country are seeing their dollar being absolutely destroyed. And when they go to the store, they're having a heart attack every time. Hopefully, at some point, they will connect the dots and realize the person picking their pockets are the rich people who live up in McLean, Virginia. That's where the problems are.
Yeah. But you know what's interesting? Everything you just said, that is the realization of places like Africa, parts of the Middle East, and, you know, certainly in Latin America, which has been besieged in the past by CIA tactics that have killed hundreds of thousands of people, as I well know, because it's where I come from. Americans don't buy into that. They don't understand. I watched the interview the other day with some folks. I don't know if I was watching CNN or Fox or one of those cable channels that are all full of crap. And it was amazing to me. They interviewed people and they were saying things like, well, if my president says we need to do that, I trust him because, you know, in fact, I think he should just choose his successor if he gets too old. And they were saying things where their trust in this political institution, you know, these politicians just makes me feel like, wow, what? Why aren't they questioning? Why aren't they asking the questions that Rand Paul was questioning? Why is that?
I think Americans are the most propagandized people on earth. You know, at least in the Soviet period, they realized their government was lying to them. Americans don't. They're shoveled a big pile of crap and told that it's delicious chocolate pudding. You know, I mean, I hate to be so crude, but that's exactly what it is. And that's one thing. And the other thing is that Americans don't travel. They have absolutely no idea what the rest of the world is like. And that makes our foreign policy cost-free. They don't see the results and consequences of sanctions, of bombing, of starving kids. They never see it. And so therefore, they just support it because they think it makes us strong and respected overseas, but it doesn't.
And then there's the demonization aspect. I am always taken aback by how we can, and by the way, we're fickle about this because who we demonize today will be our friend tomorrow. But like right now, it's the demonization of Putin, Xi, Khomeini, Maduro, there's a certain strategy, almost like a marketing strategy. These are the people we hate, and you have to hate them too, So therefore, we're going to make sure our media, you know, the Anderson Coopers and of the world and the Sean Hannitys and these idiots, you know, are going to convince you to hate these people. And by the way, I'm no fan of Xi or Khomeini or Maduro or Putin or any of these guys. But come on.
I mean, who would you rather have a beer with, them or Biden? Right?
Biden, we'd have to first wake him up, but continue.
Yeah. I mean, Biden is so detached from reality. His recent speech to America about the Middle East was so detached from reality. He even trotted out the old domino theory. If we don't stop Putin now, he's going to take over Poland, which is absolutely asinine. It was stupid the first time around. And, you know, things like America is the essential country over and over again. You know, it's these platitudes that are spoken by our leaders are assisting in dumbing us down.
Well, I'll tell you what, Dan, it's a great conversation. And I do wish that somebody at the State Department or somebody somewhere within our system is listening to us and trying to make that deviation, because I think if ever we've needed it, it's now, and especially in the weeks and months to come. Thank you, my friend. Daniel McAdam, Executive Director of the Ron Paul Institute. My thanks once again.
Thank you.
You know, before we go, I want to remind you of our mission, what we try and do here on a weekly basis. It's simple, really. I'd like to de-silo the world. We've got to stop living in little boxes, because truth doesn't live in little boxes where you only hear your point of view. Truths are everywhere. I'm Rick Sanchez, and I'll be looking for you right here again as we try to provide a direct impact.